This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When scientists tested out chlamydia vaccines, about 50 years ago now, things didn't always go as planned. The vaccines, which were usually tested out on people living in developing countries, including kids, made some people more susceptible to contracting this sexually transmitted infection. And until recently, researchers couldn't figure out why. Well, joining me now to unravel this medical mystery and share her other top picks for this week's short stories in science is Ariel Duham Ross. She's a science reporter at The Verge in New York City. Welcome back.
Hi, Ira.
Let's talk about this first. What went wrong with chlamydia vaccines in the 60s?
Right. Well, I mean, they did something that was very conventional. They tried to use, you know, chlamydia is a bacterial infection, so right. They tried to use dead chlamydia bacteria to make a vaccine in the 1960s. But like you said, that really didn't work out because people actually became more susceptible. And interestingly enough, in the opposite direction, if you've had chlamydia before and you've cleared the infection, if you have it a second time, you clear it far more quickly and you actually build up like a natural immunity. So people who had had it did a lot better than the people who had the vaccine. And this has stayed a mystery for 50 years. Some scientists have been working on trying to figure out a new vaccine, but it's really taken a while and researchers don't know why, and they haven't been able to really test it on humans because of this like really terrible precedent.
Mm-hmm.
So researchers recently tried to recreate those experiments in mice. So what they did is that they put their immune systems in contact with either dead chlamydia cells or live chlamydia cells. And what they found is that your T cells react very differently. T cells are white blood cells. They're part of the immune system, and they react very differently based on whether you're in contact with dead or live chlamydia cells. If you are in contact with live chlamydia cells, they become protective, and that's how you build immunity. If you're in contact with dead cells, they become regulatory cells, and they kind of like let chlamydia chill out in your body. And armed with that knowledge, they were able to find a workaround. They were able to devise using it's really cool. They were able to like combine, I guess the best way to explain it is that they tried to use something called an adjuvant. It's a substance that is able to boost your immune system.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to mix it with dead chlamydia cells, but that didn't work very well. So instead, they tried to attach the adjuvants directly to the chlamydia cells. And they did that using nanoparticles. And it did finally work. They were able to kind of re-educate the T cells in the mice to make them react more appropriately and then be able to like build immunity against chlamydia. What's really interesting about this is that actually what they're considering is to make this a nasal spray. And the reason that you can do that is that either you can educate your T cells to become, to like travel to your mucosa, which are the linings of like your nose, linings of your mouth, the linings of the uterus is mucosa, or you can educate them to go to your T cells. So if you do it through, to go to your skin, and if you do it through a nasal spray, then mm-hmm. you can have those T cells that are finally doing what they're supposed to be doing, travel to the uterus and then work out pretty well. This is really important because chlamydia is the most widespread bacterial STI. And it has some pretty terrible side effects. It causes infertility in women. So this is actually like really, it's good news.
Mm.
It's early, but good news.
Well, that's always good to hear. Next up, you've got a story about a whole slew of new bacteria found out in Colorado.
Yeah.
You know we love bacteria on this
show. Oh, I do too. microbiologists discovered 35 new groups of bacteria in Colorado in groundwater. What's cool about this is that if you kind of take a step back and look at the tree of life, those 35 new groups are equivalent. That's about the same number of groups that we know of in the like animal kingdom. So those groups include things like mammals, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So and those 35 new groups really only account for 15% of the bacteria on Earth. It really kind of puts humanity into perspective because we basically represent nothing when it comes to the Tree of Life. We are very, very unimportant. And to me, that really helps hit that home. The other cool thing about these bacteria is that they're very different from other types of bacteria that we've seen before. They have a different type of metabolism. They need other types of bacteria to survive. And they're very, very, very small. They're about 4 nanometers across, 400 nanometers across. So, I mean, we don't know a lot about them, but it really just kind of shows that we are not very important.
Wow. And it sounds like you've come up with a story like there might be a new effective treatment for malaria.
Yeah. This new drug, there was a study published this week. It's a single dose treatment that was able to cure mice of malaria.
That's pretty big.
The reason it's big is because most malaria drugs need to be taken more than once, over a number of days to really help somebody out. The other really important thing about this is that it was actually able to prevent infection in mice, and it was able to prevent transmission from mice who had malaria to mosquitoes. So it actually has like this very broad acting way. And the way that it does this is that it does something new that we haven't been able to do before with malaria, is that it attacks a protein that helps, that aids in protein production in the entire malaria parasite. So, like, it kind of disrupts many, many different processes in the malaria parasite.
Mm-hmm. One last thing. What's this about a shape-shifting dust cloud on the moon?
Yeah. So this has kind of an interesting history, because in the 70s, during the Apollo missions, Apollo 15 and Apollo 17, astronauts kind of saw this weird glow around the moon, and they didn't know why. Turns out that they figured it was probably a dust cloud, and now we finally have actually confirmation that there is a dust cloud around the moon, but it turns out that it's not the same dust cloud that they saw back in the 70s. So we still don't have much information about the dust cloud, but the reasons why we know that it's not the same one is because it has very different properties from one that would be able to create that glow. Mm-hmm. It's too close to the moon to be able to create that kind of glow. What we do know about the dust cloud is that it's created from, we think, tiny collisions of comet dust particles with the moon's surface. What's, I guess, important and really relevant about this is that finding this around the moon means that there may be also other dust clouds around other airless planetary bodies in space. And that has implications for space travel, because those kinds of dust particles could be damaging for spacecraft. They could be damaging for astronauts.
Right.
Kind of an important thing to know.
Thank you. Thanks for coming by. We've run out of time. Ariel Dohm-Ross is a science reporter at The Verge in New York. Next up, it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And today's story, the miraculous awakening of the Philae lander, which fell into a sort of a computer coma after its bouncing landing on the comet 67P. But last weekend, it woke up and transmitted a message and said, "Hey, guys, I'm here." And then it woke up again today, and here to tell us the good and the bad of the unexpected wake-up is Tarek Malik, managing editor at space.com here in New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Glad to be here, Ira.
All right, so what's the good thing?
Well, the great thing, the good thing is, first of all, it's alive. It's awake. After 7 months of silence, this Philae lander, woke up, sent a couple of days' worth of hellos to ground control, and then again today, sent some more. So they know that it's, working. They also know that it can communicate back with its mothership, Rosetta, around the comet, which can then beam those signals back. They also learned today that it's gotten warmer over the last week, warm enough now that its batteries, which have been kind of like in deep freeze, can store power. And that's really important, because the warmer it gets, the more power it can store over time. And then it can use that power when there isn't any sunlight to maybe do science. Everyone loves an underdog. Really sad after only 60 hours that it the Philae kind of went silent. It didn't land in sunlight. It kind of bounced a couple times and settled under a cliff, which is bad if you're a solar-powered a probe.
You hate it when that happens. It,
you know, it just ruins your day. And so now, finally, it just woke up on its own, and by chance, they were able to get the signal back.
So what could be the bad thing about this?
Well, right now, communications are everything, and it's very spotty. They've had these three kind of connections over time. They're only getting these kind of housekeeping things, how cold it is, how much power it might have. It's not doing any science. So until they can actually get a steady stream of communications between Philae and Rosetta, its mothership, Rosetta back to Earth, that two-way is going to be vital to be able to have it do science. So that's one thing. The other thing is the comet is active, and it's, you know, sending out little jets and stuff. If it's not as secure as scientists think it is, you know, it has these harpoons that were supposed to anchor it down. They never fired. It's got a leg sticking up into space. They've got a really great picture of it. So if it gets too active, if there's a shift underneath the lander, it could shake free, bounce off, drift away, and, you know, the mission's over too. If there's too much dust around it from these jets, it could settle back onto the solar arrays and cut the amount of power it can generate, you know, which is already kind of paltry. That could also, you know, end everything now. And there's a lot of HR going on in Germany where its mission control is. These scientists human resources, because these guys, they were, we had a reporter at a conference in Chicago. They were going to give a big talk about astrobiology. They canceled everything because they had to now start shifting back to this mission that they kind of had thought they were done with. So they've got that mission control back up and running now. But it's been a big juggle this week to get those folks back in the office.
So they may be sitting around looking at a spacecraft that's really not very useful, even though we like it, and it's sitting there and they're spending a lot of human hours working on something that they could be doing something better, doing something else.
Exactly. You can imagine these scientists might have kind of given up hope, maybe made plans for a summer vacation. Now they're coming back, changing everything on the hopes that they can actually get this thing to do some science.
And who knows? We just have to wait till it warms up a little bit more.
Yeah, we have to wait. We've got a few months before it gets as close to the sun as it's going to get in August. So they've got some time to kind of really get this engine going.
Well, Tariq, thanks for taking time to be with us today. We'll be watching.
A pleasure.
Tariq Malik is managing editor at space.com here in New York. Taking a break. When we come back, we're going to look at a dino-sized bite out of box office records. You know, did you see Jurassic World? What did you think? But what did the scientists who watch it think? Maybe different than what you think. Stay with us. We'll be right back for a movie review with paleontologists after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow.
The most spectacular science shocker ever filmed. Too real to be science fiction. Now, science fact.
Ah, yes. Time for Science Goes to the Movies, our series where we ask scientists to think like film critics and weigh in on a science flick. And this week we're headed, how could we not, to Jurassic World. Now, that's a lot's happened to the island since Alan Grant and company visited way back in 1993. You remember what happened that time? Well, Jurassic World picks up 20 years later, the world's first dino theme park. It's Jurassic World is finally open for business, but business ain't so good. And through the miracle of genetic engineering, dinosaurs have become common. What kid hasn't supped with a saurus? They just know that. They got to wow the kids like they used to. So what do? Park execs decide that Jurassic World really needs a new attraction. So they've entered the gene-spliced ultra Indominus Rex, yep, the top leading dinosaur of the Jurassic World.
You just went and made a new dinosaur?
Probably not a good idea.
Almost 40 feet high. Really think she climbed out?
Depends.
On what?
What kind of dinosaur they cooked up in that lab.
Oh yeah, oh scientists, they're always forgetting that life finds a way. So what did real life dino scientists think of the movie? We're going to ask them. Kenneth LaCavera is a professor of paleontology and paleontology fellow at the Academy of Natural Sciences at Drexel University in Philadelphia. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. Great to be back.
Great. Lindsay Zano heads the Paleontology Research Lab at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. Welcome to Science Friday.
Nice to be here.
Ken, Lindsay, let's get some first impressions. Do you like going to movies about dinosaurs? Yeah,
sure.
They enjoy them as much as we
wouldn't?
Do.
Yeah, I think
yeah,
so.
Yeah.
And you know, it's easy to be pedantic about a movie like this and pick nits, but, you know, this is a fun summer monster movie, and on that level, it works really well. I had a good time.
Do you think, Lindsay, it gets people thinking about science of dinosaurs?
I suppose it does. I mean, I don't know that it does that as much as, say, a documentary would. I don't know that the dinosaurs in this movie really have a lot in common with the dinosaurs as we know them, but it definitely sparks some interest and imagination, and anything that does that is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I was watching it, I thought there was a lot less emphasis on the science of the dinosaurs and how they made the dinosaurs, recreated them in this movie than they did in the original Jurassic Park. At least in the original, they took us into the lab. They had that little Adam jumping around and talking about how we recreate the dinosaurs, but very little of that. Mm-hmm. We saw he did make a cameo in this movie, but didn't really have much to do with the plot.
Yeah, there was no paleontologist in this movie, which was a bit of a disappointment.
Yeah, the hero was not a scientist in this movie. You're right. That's another change.
Yeah, I think it's interesting in that they sort of explain away the dinosaurs as reproductions of real dinosaurs early on, and that almost makes the movie easier as a scientist to swallow because you can kind of dismiss with the idea that these are supposed to be factual representations of those animals.
Mm-hmm. So you think that they no longer worried about getting the facts right in this movie?
Didn't seem like that was their top priority, no.
Tell me, Ken, what was the number one thing they got wrong when you say that?
Well, I guess the most obvious thing is that dinosaurs like Velociraptor and even T-Rex should have feathers in the case of Velociraptor and, you know, some kind of primitive feathers or quills for T-Rex. And Velociraptor, it was big in the last movie like it was in this movie. The actual Velociraptor's kind of tiny. It's about the size of a turkey. If a Velociraptor is in your kitchen, it's actually not that big of a problem.
You could probably kick it away instead of trying to hit it with a bomb or something.
You could, yes.
Our number, 844-724-8255. If you saw Jurassic World, you want to see it, what was your impression? You can also tweet us at SciFry, SCIFRI. Lindsay, did you have the same problem with that?
Yeah, I mean, I study theropod dinosaurs, which are the group Velociraptor belongs to. So that, of course, was the biggest issue or biggest thorn in my side in the movie. And it wasn't so much the feathers. I can sort of understand that maybe feathered raptors don't seem as scary to people as scaly ones. But they also had the raptors sort of creeping around with their hands in this sort of walking dead kind of posture. And that's really bizarre. I mean, in fact, the raptors were so different from what most paleontologists envision and know that they looked like. They were almost aliens. It was a really bizarre thing to watch them. They didn't resonate with me as sort of raptor dinosaurs at all.
Ken, what did you make of the park's new big attraction, the Indominus Rex, that they went through pains to describe how they made that?
Sure. It was supposed to be a genetic hybrid. And, you know, when you do that, I guess you have a tremendous amount of creative license. You know, and kind of the premise of this is that they're improving on, you know, good old T-Rex. But, you know, I'm not sure T-Rex needs a lot of improvement. You know, T-Rex, like all organisms, are exquisitely adapted to their environments. And, you know, the little tiny arms that get made fun of so often on the internet that T-Rex has, that's adaptive. You know, in evolution, the rule is use it or lose it. And T-Rex had exactly the arms that it needed to be successful in its environment. So, you know, you put Indominus Rex and T-Rex back in the Cretaceous, and I think T-Rex might come out on top. It's adapted.
Mm. Let's go to the phones. Isaac in Camden, South Carolina. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you for having me. It's a hot one out here.
I'll bet.
Man, I got to tell you, I'm a geologist. I've worked in mining for years, and as in my job, one of the things I do is reconstruct the paleo environment via models for finding mineral resources. And I'm so jealous that theoretically these paleontologists get the chance to see, you know, they debate what dinosaurs looked like, what they did, and theoretically for them to make them come alive, it's so cool. Like, as a scientist, it's, you know, you can sit there and argue, well, you know, they had feathers, oh, they were all these colors, but to do it, I mean, that's, geologically speaking, paleontologically speaking, that's just such a cool validation. You know, it's not like chemists or physicists or anything, they get to do their experiments and watch them unfold. When you're, you know, doing these theories based on bones and things like that, it's just such a neat idea to be able to just see it like that. And I'm totally going to go see this movie and see it.
All right, Isaac, thanks. Yeah, how do you react to what he said?
Well, you know, right from the very beginning of dinosaur paleontology, we've always had this close relationship with artists because we can't see this thing that we study. We always have kind of this unrequited love with the thing that we work on, and we need artists to kind of fill in that gap for us.
Lindsay, Chris Pratt, the hero of this movie, plays a dino whisperer, a kind of SeaWorld trainer for velociraptors. And here he is in the film trying to convince the raptors. He's tried to train them and to do what he says, and in this case, not to eat one of his colleagues.
Stand down.
Hey, hey! What did I just say? Delta, I see you. Back up. Okay. Good. Good.
Yeah. So what do you say, Lindsay? Could you train a raptor like almost like a dolphin here?
Look, if you could do that, I'd be so on board. I can't think of anything cooler than riding around town with my own pack of velociraptor. But, you know, velociraptors were extraordinarily intelligent for their day. But, you know, they're only about as smart as the dumbest of the living dinosaurs, which we call birds. So it's probably a little out of the question that you could really train them for this kind of purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, they shoot down another theory. Ken, one of the stars of the movie is a gigantic mosasaur. Tell us about this creature.
Yeah, so mosasaur, one of my favorites. First of all, not a dinosaur. It's a marine reptile. If you think of a Komodo dragon, imagine a Komodo dragon that's as long as a school bus, has paddles for limbs, a very long jaw, and then inside its mouth, at the top of its throat, it has a second set of teeth that point backwards to keep you from swimming back out. So this thing's a sea monster, and I was looking very closely in the movie when this thing pops out of the tank to eat the great white shark. They had those palate teeth at the top of the throat. So you got to give them kudos for that one. That's something that's pretty obscure that they got right in the movie.
Wait, was it the right size? They got it the right size in the movie?
No, it was too big. I don't think there were any mosasaurs that were the size of the one in the movie. But they were big. They got up to be, you know, 50, 55, maybe 60 feet long, some of the biggest.
What do you folks think of a 2010 survey that found that 43% of people, Americans, believe that dinos and humans lived at the same time? I mean, that the Flintstones were real.
They do.
You know?
Well, they do in the sense that dinosaurs are not extinct. And this is something that we as paleontologists have been pushing really hard to express to the public because it's such a wondrous moment and a way to resonate, you know, with these animals. We talk about de-extinction and dinosaurs and bringing them back to life in Jurassic Park, but you don't need a Jurassic Park to watch a dinosaur or have an interaction with a dinosaur because they're not gone. So while that data that they're talking about is more about the extinct kinds of dinosaurs and means that we as paleontologists have a lot more work to do getting our message out, I think we also need to get the message out to help people understand that they can interact with dinosaurs today and that it's not that far-fetched of an idea.
When you say dinosaur today, you're talking about birds, right?
I am. I'm talking about birds. And, you know, if I had to pick one dinosaur group to actually make it through that extinction event, you know, I can't think of a better group to pick than birds. And they were the only ones, of course, to survive that cataclysmic event. I mean, can you imagine bringing sauropods back to life and having them sort of wreak havoc, these long-necked, 100-foot-long dinosaurs? We wouldn't want to do that. We wouldn't want ornery ceratopsians or horned dinosaurs. But birds, actually, I think are, you know, pretty good choice for living alongside of us today.
Mm. I want to return and, to... I'm sorry, go ahead, Ken.
Ira, if I could add, I think that number, what that really reflects is the acceptance of evolution in the United States and the acceptance of the fact of the antiquity of the Earth. And those numbers have been disappointingly low for decades, and they come in at around 45% for the people that subscribe to the fact of evolution. And so if you don't think that that works, and if you don't think that the Earth is old, then you probably think that humans and dinosaurs live together. And so that's a much bigger problem that we have with our educational system.
Mm-hmm. I want to return to Jurassic Park, the original movie, for a moment and play a clip from the first movie where they explain how they brought the dinos back.
Sometimes, after biting a dinosaur, the mosquito would land on the branch of a tree and get stuck in the sap. After a long time, the tree sap would get hard and become fossilized, just like a dinosaur bone, preserving the mosquito inside. This fossilized tree sap, which we call amber, waited for millions of years with the mosquito inside, until Jurassic Park scientists came along. Using sophisticated techniques, they extract the preserved blood from the mosquito and, bingo, dino DNA.
There you go. That was from the original Jurassic Park. And we are talking about dinosaurs, Jurassic Park, and Jurassic World on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Ken Lecavara and Lindsay Zano. We've talked about before how impossible it is to, you know, to get viable DNA out of a mosquito that's been in amber so long. But there was some real interesting research just announced last week about getting soft tissue out of fossils of dinosaurs. What do you think of that?
Well, that work has been pioneered by a colleague of Lindsay and mine, Mary Schweitzer at North Carolina State. And Mary has been able to recover proteins and blood vessels and blood cells from ancient dinosaurs, a T-Rex and a duckbill dinosaur. And then this study last week, which was by another group, they've recovered what they believe are red blood cells from a dinosaur. And so this is really where the action is in what we call molecular paleontology. I'm not sure that dinosaur DNA will ever be recovered. Mm-hmm. DNA is not a very stable molecule, but we can recover proteins and other tissues from dinosaurs.
Let's go to the phones. I want to go to Jordan in Lodi, California. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, I just had some genetic biologist point of view about the Indominus Rex that kind of bothers me.
Well, go ahead. Talk about it.
So the Indominus Rex is supposed to be a combination of different dinosaurs and different modern-day species to make the ultimate monster, which ultimately, you know, life finds a way, wreaks havoc, but in ways that it shouldn't. Like, they give the example of they put a tree frog gene in the Indominus Rex to better cope with the habitat, the rainforest habitat. But then a side effect is that it is able to hide its infrared output. That should not be possible. If you are in modern day genetics, you are able to select very specific genes from an organism and put it into another, unless you're talking about like the original Jurassic Park where, oh, we just filled in all the holes with code from another animal. But no, in this case, they were selecting specific genes, so there should not have been such drastic side effects.
Let me ask Ken or Lindsay.
Yeah, well, this was an interesting aspect to the movie, and it's funny that we've always been, the media has sort of been talking to paleontologists incessantly about Jurassic World, but I feel like it's the genomicists and the geneticists who probably have the most beef with this plot line in this movie, because the things that they do with the genetic engineering really don't add up to what we would expect.
Mm-hmm. Are we any closer to, even with the soft tissue that we talked about, is there anything in that new soft tissue that might help us recreate a dinosaur?
Understand dinosaurs, not recreate them, not from proteins. But people are working in embryology to tweak the genes of chickens to reactivate their non-avian dinosaur traits. And so that's an ongoing line of work. You're never going to create a non-avian dinosaur again, but you can have a bird like a chicken that has some of those traits that are displayed.
What would you like to see if they do? Obviously, they're going to do a follow-up. I shouldn't say obviously. What would you like to see in the next film as a scientist?
Oh, well, I think one of my favorites is a dinosaur called Therizinosaurus, which had sort of 4 to 5 foot long claws on its hands and was sort of a cross between an ostrich and Edward Scissorhands and a gorilla with a big pot belly. Really bizarre feathered creature. There have been a lot of great discoveries. Another animal called Dinochirus, which is sort of like an overgrown duck / ostrich with a hump on its back, and just some amazing things coming out of Asia that I think we'd all like to see.
Wow.
Some new, exciting discoveries, perhaps the bat-like feathered dinosaur that was discovered recently, Yichi. So there's a lot of awesome options.
We'll have to wait for that one. Kenneth Lacavara, professor of paleontology and geology at Drexel, Lindsay Zano, paleontology research lab, North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to look at the climate of ancient Mars. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The surface of Mars is covered with valleys and channels and plenty of evidence of perhaps oceans full of water eons ago. But a group of researchers says that Mars may have had a cold, icy past, that the planet may have been covered in ice 3 billion years ago. They looked at geological clues that point to a cold and icy climate rather than a warm, ocean-covered planet that we always talk about. The results are in the Journal of Geophysical Research, Planets. Laura Kerber is a co-author on that study. She's also a research scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
This is a new idea, sort of a new idea, is it not?
This is an idea that's sort of been tossed around for a little while now, because we've had this enduring mystery where we see all these channels that indicate there was lots of water on the surface in the past. But then on the climate modeling side, when we try and figure out what was necessary in order to make the climate warm enough to have that flowing water, it's really hard for us to do using physical means. So we could try a really thick CO2 atmosphere, perhaps, or different kinds of greenhouse gases. And so it's been hard for us as climate modelers to make the climate warm enough in order for what the geologists see to be, you know, what happened in the past. And so we get our cues from the geologists. They say that there's rivers and lakes. That has to be what happened. So I think people have been pushing back and saying, okay, if there were rivers and lakes, how long did they have to be there? And did it have to be really, really warm? Or could it have been really cold, in this case with snow falling on the surface and then that snow melting and forming the rivers and lakes instead of just rain falling?
So how do you get the climate to be so cold that you had it icy like that?
So in the past, the sun was probably less bright than it was today, maybe 75% of its strength that it is today. And over time, the sun has grown brighter and brighter. And so Mars already has 40% of the radiation reaching it that the Earth does. And so Mars would just naturally be extremely cold in the past. And so the default is sort of that Mars is extremely cold. And then in order to get it warmer, we have to do special things. It has to have a particular kind of atmosphere with a really strong greenhouse effect. And that's been the thing that's been difficult for us to do. Given the faint young sun, it's difficult for us to make the planet warm enough. So the clever thing that Robin Wordsworth was the lead author on this study, his idea was, okay, we have a hard time getting the climate warm enough. Let's just artificially make it warm enough by making the sun brighter, or conversely, by sort of introducing a false greenhouse effect, and then seeing what the precipitation patterns would be if we did have a warm Mars, and do they match up with the valley networks that we see on the surface. And when we did that, we found that the precipitation patterns in the warm scenario weren't matching up with where the locations of the valley networks were. But if we just kept with the old sort of normal, ordinary, colder Mars, then all of the ice was accumulating in the places where we do see valley networks. So in that case, all you'd need to do is get it warm enough to melt that ice and form those valleys.
So the cold model fits better what we see today. But how did the planet get cold back then? We thought it would be a hot planet.
Right. So from the geologic record, we see a lot of evidence that there was flowing water on the surface. Some of these rivers go for thousands of kilometers, and they have multiple lakes, and there's some evidence that there could be an ocean. All of these things immediately led the geologists to suggest that it was warm in the past. And so then the next step was to figure out, okay, why was it warm in the past and it's not warm today? What happened to the Martian climate back then that made it different than what it is now, which is a sort of a cold and dry desert? And so that's when people started experimenting with models, trying to say, okay, if we change certain things about the Martian atmosphere, would it be much warmer? Is the atmospheric temperature really sensitive to different things like the amount of CO2 that's in the atmosphere? Or perhaps there was SO2 in the atmosphere, and that made it a lot warmer in the past.
Well, what I'm asking is, if you say it was so cold and frozen 3 billion years ago, what was doing that? Why was it so cold and frozen with all that water then?
I think the key is that the sun was so cold that it just should have been cold in the past, if you think about it physically.
So that, you know, we have our seasons here because the Earth's tilted. The axes are tilted, and we get it summer, the seasons, because of the tilted. Did that also happen on Mars? Maybe the tilting changed on the axis.
Yes, and actually the tilt of the Martian axis changes a lot more than the tilt of the Earth's axis. So the tilt of the Earth's axis is about 23.5 degrees. Mars right now is about 25, so very similar. But the Martian axis, it changes a lot in the past. So they think in the past it could have been up to, you know, maybe 60 degrees of tilt. And so in that case, wow, it wobbles back and forth chaotically throughout the history of Mars. And this causes ice to move from the equator to the pole and back to the equator. And so that cycle is laid upon this greater cycle wherein the Martian atmosphere was nicer in the past and is slowly getting colder and colder towards the present. And then laid upon that is this cycle of obliquity change, the change in the Earth's axis, which is making ice go back and forth. And so when we make the models, we have to put that in there too, because sort of climate change on Mars is much more extreme than climate change on the Earth, because Mars at axis changes so much it's not as constrained as that of the Earth.
So what do you have to do to get your model more accepted by everybody?
So I think what's happening is there's been an iteration between the modelers who are saying, you know, we think that ancient Mars was really cold based on, you know, the sun and all of these other things. And then the geologists who come back and say, well, you know, the rock record seems to suggest that it was warm. And so as we iterate back and forth, the geologists say, you know, maybe you don't need it to be as warm for these rivers to form. Maybe the rivers could have been ice covered, or maybe they could have formed during short periods of time, an excursion of climate where it became really hot for just a little while, a couple of thousands of years. And so it's been a really good back and forth between the climate modelers and the geologists to try and figure out what really happened in the Martian past.
All right. Well, we'll stay tuned and see how that turns out. Dr. Kerber. Laura Kerber is a research scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks.
The movie Jaws is making a comeback in theaters this summer, but why wait to celebrate the creatures of the deep?
I'd like to be under the sea, in an octopus's garden in the shade.
Because this week we kick off Science Friday's second annual Cephalopod Week. We've got videos to amuse, activities to choose to celebrate the squishy tentacled sea creatures. And here as masters of ceremony to all the fun we have planned for the week, our video producer Luke Graskin and SciFry community manager Brandon Echter.
Well, that's kind of, you know, this is kind of fun. We have chosen, Luke, a group of animals on the planet to celebrate, but not tigers and parrots and sloths. Why cephalopods?
Well, when you think about all the qualities that you like in a lot of these different sort of animals, you think of the fierceness of predators like tigers, and you think of the enormity of a blue whale, or you think of the intelligence of a parrot or a dolphin, or the flashiness of a peacock. Well, this class of animals, cephalopods, squids, nautilus, octopus, they've got all that. They've got all of that, and it's all bundled up in these tiny invertebrate bodies. Invertebrates are a group of species that we don't typically pay attention to. So let's celebrate them.
Let's do that.
And more so, unlike some other, you know, animal-themed weeks out there, Shark Week, we like to focus a little bit more on the science and some of the amazing fields of study that come out of these animals, such as, you know, behaviorists that study their camouflage, which are roboticists that study how their tentacles work, or how evolutionary biologists look at how we came to intelligence and how these invertebrates, a completely separate line that has more in common with snails, has problem-solving skills and intelligence of their own.
Mm-hmm. Also, they're just really, really cool.
So what are the cephalopods? What does the family includes what? They're octopus?
They're octopus. There's cuttlefish. There's squid. There are nautilus. And then there are these other kind of ambiguous octopus-like creatures, like the vampire squid, which is neither a squid nor a vampire, obviously. And then there's other things like these little squishy kind of octopus-like creatures that live in the deep ocean as well.
All right, Brandon, let's talk about the kind of fun activities you have planned for this week.
Oh, we have so much fun stuff this week, Ira. Like, we have two videos that we put up about two different different octopus species. We also are producing some stories on our website, one of which is going to be about this really cool species called the cockeye squid, where one has a really giant eye and one has a very small eye. And we're also going to be interviewing the cuttlefish cephalopod caretaker, at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And we also have some education activities. We're going to be, you can make your own proto-cephalopod and test jet propulsion with one of our education activities. We're also going to have a Google Hangout where people can talk to people, cephalopod researchers. There's a lot of stuff going on. We're also doing, Monterey Bay Aquarium is also going to be producing a lot of stuff. Also, the Museum of, American Museum of Natural History. So it's going to be a big cephalo party.
Wow. We might have a lot of time for that. There's also a new macroscope video that we're featuring this week, right?
That's right. It's called Isn't This Adorabilis, which is a tiny little squishy species of octopus that was found in the deep sea off the coast of California. It's really, really cute.
It is adorable.
It is so adorable. People have compared it to Pokemon. They've compared it to the Pac-Man ghost. They've compared it to Pearl from Finding Nemo. And let me tell you, Ira, this video has gone crazy viral. Just under 1 million people have seen it right before we stepped into the studio. So you've got to see it if you haven't already. It's very, very cute.
It's up there on our website now, right?
Yes, it's on sciencefriday.com.
And Luke, the researchers are interested in it not just because how cute it is, right?
Yeah, that's right. So they collected a couple of specimens off the coast of California. They brought it back to the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And those specimens unfortunately died. But when they went to check on them before they died, they found eggs there, and they still have these eggs. And in fact, our video producer, Christian Baker, wasn't even allowed to film those eggs because they didn't want to disturb them. They were trying to be so careful to make sure that they incubated. And they take up to 2 to 3 years to actually incubate, which is not unheard of for deep sea species. And they're hoping that they can learn a lot more about this animal's environment and its ecology by kind of studying how long it takes to incubate these eggs and sort of how long its life cycle is and how it breeds and how many eggs it actually lays and things like that.
We're talking about cephalopod this week on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with Brandon Ector and Luke Raskin. We should call it International Cephalopod Week, right?
Oh, yeah. We absolutely should. Actually, there's already a Chinese equivalent hashtag. I'm not even going to try to pronounce it here. But this is something that we want everybody in the world to participate in. So I'm going to put the call out right now. So if you we want you to share your art. We want you to share your favorite cephalopod stories. We want to know what your favorite cephalopod is. And you can do that just by tweeting at it with the hashtag Cephalopod Week.
We even have one of our staff out on a ship, right?
Yes, Ariel Zitch, our education manager. She is out on the Nautilus, which is a very appropriate name, which is Dr. Bob Ballard's ship, and she is looking at the deep sea, and she's also going to be on there with a bunch of cephalopod researchers, also looking at mussels and other deep sea creatures. So there's a lot of stuff to do.
Then not only we don't have just one video this week, we have two bonus videos.
Yeah, so if the other species of octopus we were talking about is Adorabilis, this other species that's in featured in our second video probably should be called Athleticus for what it does. So it's not actually called that. It's actually called the algae octopus. And the algae octopus does this weird behavior where it literally stands up on two arms. They're not legs. Do not call octopus arms legs. If you do that, you will be frowned upon in the cephalopod community. So it stands up on two arms, and it scampers backwards, just on those two legs. You have to see this. It's an
It is amazing. I've seen the video.
It's an underwater invertebrate that actually stands up and runs. It's bizarre.
Runs
it's
on the sand. It's running when you think it should be
jetting.
Right.
It could be jetting. It could be crawling. It could be swimming. But for some reason, this species and a couple other species actually stand up and they run. And the question is, why? Why would this creature do that? Of all the forms of locomotion that it could go through, it chooses to do the Ministry of Silly Walks backwards walk. It's very, very, very weird. Mm-hmm. But the researcher, Dr. Chrissy Hufford, she has a theory, and it's pretty well backed up, that the animal, when the animal is actually jetting away, where it fills its mantle with water and it squeezes it out, that's its normal escape strategy. When it does that, its heart stops. Its heart literally stops. The only other time, by the way, that happens with octopus is when they are mating. Yes, their heart stops when they mate.
It's very romantic.
It is. Well, maybe we should rebrand. If people are taking pictures, they're taking selfies of themselves and their octopuses, maybe we should call it a selfie with a C.
C-E-L-P-H-I-E, or a selfie lopod, if you will. Like people should, if you happen to have a picture with your favorite octopus or your favorite squid or my personal favorite, the cuttlefish, you can take a picture of it with yourself. We're also going to be having next week some printouts that people can print out and color in themselves, so keep an eye out for that.
Mm-hmm. And they can see all of this where?
They can see all of this at our home site, which is cephalopodweek.tumblr.com.
Mm-hmm. And you can catch the videos on sciencefriday.com. If you like them, subscribe. If not, just share them. And if you like the name Adorabilis, go watch it. Go watch it, because that will count towards the scientist deciding whether or not to call it.
Because they haven't named it yet.
They haven't even named it yet.
Our listeners, can influence the naming.
That's right. That's right. The more people that will watch it, the more there'll be a mandate to call it Adorabilis.
How can we not? Thank you both. Luke Raskin, our video producer. Brandon Echter, our Sci-Fry community manager, will be playing and having fun with Cephalopod Week all week long. Thank you for joining us. You're welcome. Oh, one last thing. About 1 in 10 of you listening is left-handed, assuming you're human, that is. About 10% of the human population worldwide is made up of lefties, but research published this week in the journal Current Biology finds that kangaroos tilt the other way. On a population level, it turns out that kangaroos are left-handed. Studies show they prefer their left hands for things like eating and grooming themselves, but perhaps we shouldn't be so surprised by this. As residents of Australia, they should be natural lefties, the real southpaws. That's about all the time we have for today. Giles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Taliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. SciArts producer is Annie Minoff. Luke Raskin, our video producer. Our production assistant, Becky Fogel. Intern, Ella Fetter. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman, our engineer at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. I'm sure you know what a magnet is, but how about a liquid magnet? It's called a ferrofluid, and it makes some pretty incredible shapes, almost like an alien crossed with a gummy candy. Weird stuff. It's our picture of the week up at sciencefriday.com/liquidmagnet. Check it out as you're checking out the cephalopods. I'm Ira Flato in New York.